This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents The Second Gong, a Hercule Poirot short story by Agatha Christie, performed by Hugh Fraser.
The Second Gong. Joan Ashby came out of her bedroom and stood a moment on the landing outside her door. She was half-turning as if to go back into the room when, below her feet, as it seemed, a gong boomed out. Immediately, Joan started forward, almost at a run. So great was her hurry that at the top of the big staircase she collided with a young man arriving from the opposite direction.
"Hello, Joan. Why the wild hurry?"
"Sorry, Harry. I didn't see you."
"So I gathered," said Harry Dalehouse dryly. "But as I say, why the wild haste?"
"It was the gong."
"I know, but it's only the first gong."
"No, it's the second."
"First?"
"Second."
Thus arguing, they had been descending the stairs. They were now in the hall, where the butler, having replaced the gong stick, was advancing toward them at a grave and dignified pace.
"It's the second," persisted Joan. "I know it is."
"Well, for one thing, look at the time."
Harry Dalehouse glanced up at the grandfather clock.
"Well, just 8:12, he remarked. "Joan, I believe you're right. But I never heard the first one." "Digby," he addressed the butler, "is this the first gong or the second?"
"The first, sir."
"At 8:12?
"Digby, somebody will get the sack for this." A faint smile showed for a minute on the butler's face.
"Dinner is being served 10 minutes later tonight, sir. The master's orders."
"Incredible," cried Harry Dalehouse. "Tut, tut, upon my word, things are coming to a pretty pass. Wonders will never cease. What ails my revered uncle?"
"The 7 o'clock train, sir, was 30 minutes late, and as—"
The butler broke off, as a sound like the crack of a whip was heard.
"What on earth?" said Harry. "Why, that sounded exactly like a shot."
A dark, handsome man of 35 came out of the drawing-room on their left.
"What was that?" he asked. "It sounded exactly like a shot."
"It must have been a car backfiring, sir," said the butler.
"The road runs quite close to the house this side, and the upstairs windows are open."
"Perhaps," said Joan doubtfully.
"But that will be over there." She waved a hand to the right. "And I thought the noise came from here."
She pointed to the left. The dark man shook his head.
"I don't think so. I was in the drawing room. I came out here because I thought the noise came from this direction."
He nodded his head in front of him, in the direction of the gong and the front door.
"East, west, and south, eh?" said the irrepressible Harry. "Well, I'll make it complete, Keen. North for me. I thought it came from behind us. Any solutions offered?"
"Well, there's always murder," said Geoffrey Keane, smiling.
"I beg your pardon, Miss Ashby."
"Only a shiver," said Joan. "It's nothing.
What you call it, walking over my grave."
"Good thought, murder," said Harry. "But alas, no groans, no blood. I fear the solution is a poacher after a rabbit."
"Seems tame, but I suppose that's it," agreed the other. "But it sounded so near. However, let's come into the drawing-room."
"Thank goodness we're not late," said Joan fervently. "I was simply hearing it down the stairs, thinking that was the second gong."
All laughing, they went into the big drawing-room. Litcham Close was one of the most famous old houses in England. Its owner, Hubert Litcham Roche, was the last of a long line, and his more distant relatives were apt to remark that old Hubert, you know, really ought to be certified. Mad as a hatter, poor old bird. Allowing for the exaggeration, natural to friends and relatives, some truth remained. Hubert Litcham Roche was certainly eccentric. Though a very fine musician, he was a man of ungovernable temper and had an almost abnormal sense of his own importance. People staying in the house had to respect his prejudices, or else they were never asked again. One such prejudice was his music. If he played to his guests, as he often did in the evening, absolute silence must obtain. A whispered comment, a rustle of a dress, a movement even, and he would turn round scowling fiercely, and goodbye to the unlucky guest's chances of being asked again. Another point was absolute punctuality for the crowning meal of the day. Breakfast was immaterial. You might come down at noon if you wished. Lunch also, a simple meal of cold meats and stewed fruit. But dinner was a rite, a festival, prepared by a cordon bleu whom he had tempted from a big hotel by the payment of a fabulous salary. A first gong was sounded at 8:05. At 8:15, a second gong was heard, and immediately after, the door was flung open, dinner announced to the assembled guests, and a solemn procession wended its way to the dining room. Anyone who had the temerity to be late for the second gong was henceforth excommunicated, and Litcham Close shut to the unlucky diner forever. Hence the anxiety of Joan Ashby, and also the astonishment of Harry Dalehouse at hearing that the sacred function was to be delayed 10 minutes on this particular evening. Though not very intimate with his uncle, he had been to Litcham Close often enough to know what a very unusual occurrence that was. Geoffrey Keane, who was Litcham Roche's secretary, was also very much surprised. "Extraordinary," he commented. "I've never known such a thing to happen. Are you sure?" "Digby said so."
"He said something about a train," said Joan Ashby. "At least I think so."
"Queer," said Keane thoughtfully. "We shall hear all about it in due course, I suppose, but it's very odd." Both men were silent for a moment or two, watching the girl. Joan Ashby was a charming creature, blue-eyed and golden-haired, with an impish glance. This was her first visit to Litcham Close, and her invitation was at Harry's prompting. The door opened, and Diana Cleves, the Litcham Roche's adopted daughter, came into the room. There was a daredevil grace about Diana, a witchery in her dark eyes and her mocking tongue. Nearly all men fell for Diana, and she enjoyed her conquests. A strange creature, with her alluring suggestion of warmth and her complete coldness. "Beaten the old man for once," she remarked. "First time for weeks he hasn't been here first, looking at his watch and tramping up and down like a tiger at feeding time." The young man had sprung forward. She smiled entrancingly at them both, then turned to Harry. Geoffrey Keane's dark cheek flushed as he dropped back. He recovered himself, however, a moment later as Mrs. Litcham Roche came in. She was a tall, dark woman, naturally vague in manner, wearing floating draperies of an indeterminate shade of green. With her was a middle-aged man with a beak-like nose and a determined chin, Gregory Barling. He was a somewhat prominent figure in the financial world, and well-bred on his mother's side, he had for some years been an intimate friend of Hubert Litcham Roche. Boom! The gong resounded imposingly. As it died away, the door was flung open, and Digby announced, "Dinner is served." Then, well-trained servant though he was, a look of complete astonishment flashed over his impassive face. For the first time in his memory, his master was not in the room. That his astonishment was shared by everybody was evident. Mrs. Litcham Roche gave a little uncertain laugh.
"Most amazing, really. I don't know what to do."
Everybody was taken aback. The whole tradition of Litcham Close was undermined. What could have happened? Conversation ceased. There was a strained sense of waiting. At last the door opened once more. A sigh of relief went round, only tempered by a slight anxiety as to how to treat the situation. Nothing must be said to emphasize the fact that the host had himself transgressed the stringent rule of the house. But the newcomer was not Litcham Roche. Instead of the big, bearded, Viking-like figure, there advanced into the long drawing-room a very small man, palpably a foreigner, with an egg-shaped head, a flamboyant moustache, and most irreproachable evening clothes. His eyes twinkling, the newcomer advanced towards Mrs. Litcham Roche.
"My apologies, madame," he said. "I am, I fear, a few minutes late."
"Oh, not at all," murmured Mrs. Litcham Roche vaguely. "Not at all, Mr.—"
She paused.
"Poirot, madame. Hercule Poirot."
He heard behind him a very soft, "Oh," a gasp, rather than an articulate word, a woman's ejaculation. Perhaps he was flattered.
"You knew I was coming," he murmured gently, "n'est-ce pas, madame? Your husband told you."
Oh, yes, said Mrs. Litcham Roche, her manner unconvincing in the extreme.
I suppose so. I am so terribly unpractical, Monsieur Poirot. I never remember anything, but fortunately Digby sees to everything.
My train, I fear, was late, said Monsieur Poirot. An accident on the line in front of us.
Oh, cried Joan.
So that's why dinner was put off.
His eye came quickly round to her, a most uncannily discerning eye.
That is something out of the usual, huh?
I really can't think, began Mrs. Litcham Roche, and then stopped. I mean, she went on confusedly, it's so odd. Hubert never...
Poirot's eyes swept rapidly round the group.
Monsieur Litcham Roche is not down yet?
No, and it's so extraordinary.
She looked appealingly at Geoffrey Keane. A Mr. Litcham Roche is the soul of punctuality, explained Keane. He has not been late for dinner for... I don't know that he was ever late before. To a stranger, the situation must have been ludicrous. The perturbed faces, and the general consternation.
I know, said Mrs. Litcham Roche, with the air of one solving a problem. I shall ring for Digby.
She suited the action to the word. The butler came promptly.
Digby, said Mrs. Litcham Roche, your master, is he...
As was customary with her, she did not finish her sentence. It was clear that the butler did not expect her to do so. He replied promptly, and with understanding.
Mr. Litcham Roche came down at 8:05 and went into the study, madam.
Oh, she paused. You don't think... he heard the gong?
I think he must have. The gong is immediately outside the study door.
Yes, of course. Of course,
said Mrs. Litcham Roche more vaguely than ever.
Shall I inform him, madam, that dinner is ready?
Oh, thank you, Digby. Yes, I think... Yes, I should. I don't know, said Mrs. Litcham Roche to her guests as the butler withdrew, what I would do without Digby.
A pause followed. Then Digby re-entered the room. His breath was coming a little faster than is considered good form in a butler.
"Excuse me, madam. The study door is locked."
It was then that Monsieur Hercule Poirot took command of the situation.
"I think," he said, "that we had better go to the study."
He led the way, and everyone followed. His assumption of authority seemed perfectly natural. He was no longer a rather comic-looking guest. He was a personality, and master of the situation. He led the way out into the hall, past the staircase, past the great clock, past the recess in which stood the gong. Exactly opposite that recess was a closed door. He tapped on it, first gently, then with increasing violence, but there was no reply. Very nimbly, he dropped to his knees and applied his eye to the keyhole. He rose and looked around.
"Monsieur," he said,
"we must break open this door, immediately."
As before, no one questioned his authority. Geoffrey Keane and Gregory Barling were the two biggest men. They attacked the door under Poirot's directions. It was no easy matter. The doors of Litcham Close were solid affairs. No modern jerry-building here. It resisted the attack valiantly, but at last it gave before the united attack of the men and crashed inward. The house party hesitated in the doorway. They saw what they had subconsciously feared to see. Facing them was the window. On the left, between the door and the window, was a big writing table. Sitting, not at the table, but sideways to it, was a man. A big man. Slouched forward in the chair. His back was to them and his face to the window, but his position told the tale. His right hand hung limply down, and below it, on the carpet, was a small, shining pistol. Poirot spoke sharply to Gregory Barling.
Take Mrs. Litcham Roche away.
And the other two ladies.
The other nodded comprehendingly. He laid a hand on his hostess's arm. She shivered.
He has shot himself, she murmured. Horrible.
With another shiver, she permitted him to lead her away. The two girls followed. Poirot came forward into the room, the two young men behind him. He knelt down by the body, motioning them to keep back a little. He found the bullet hole on the right side of the head. It had passed out the other side and had evidently struck a mirror hanging on the left-hand wall, since this was shivered. On the writing table was a sheet of paper, blank, save for the word sorry, scrawled across it in hesitating, shaky writing. Poirot's eyes darted back to the door.
The key is not in the lock, he said. I wonder.
His hand slid into the dead man's pocket.
Here it is, he said. At least I think so.
Have the goodness to try it, monsieur.
Geoffrey Keane took it from him and tried it in the lock.
That's it, all right.
And the window?
Harry Dalehouse strode across to it.
Shut. You permit?
Very swiftly, Poirot scrambled to his feet and joined the other at the window. It was a long French window. Poirot opened it, stood a minute scrutinizing the grass just in front of it, then closed it again.
My friends, he said, we must telephone for the police. Until they have come and satisfied themselves that it is truly suicide, nothing must be touched. Death can only have occurred about a quarter of an hour ago.
I know, said Harry hoarsely. We heard the shot.
Come on. What is that you say?
Harry explained with the help of Geoffrey Keane. As he finished speaking, Barling reappeared. Poirot repeated what he had said before, and while Keane went off to telephone, Poirot requested Barling to give him a few minutes' interview. They went into a small morning room, leaving Digby on guard outside the study door, while Harry went off to find the ladies.
You were, I understand, an intimate friend of Monsieur Lichem Roche, began Poirot. It is for that reason that I address myself to you, primarily. In etiquette, perhaps I should have spoken first to Madame, but at the moment, I do not think that is pratique.
He paused.
I am, you see, in a delicate situation. I will lay the facts plainly before you. I am, by profession, a private detective.
The financier smiled a little.
It's not necessary to tell me that, Monsieur Poirot. Your name is, by now, a household word.
Monsieur is too amiable, said Poirot, bowing. Let us then proceed. I receive, at my London address, a letter from this Monsieur Lichem Roche. In it he says that he has reason to believe that he is being swindled of large sums of money. For family reasons, so he puts it, he does not wish to call in the police, but he desires that I should come down and look into the matter for him. Well, I agree. I come. Not quite so soon as Mr. Lichem Roche wishes, for after all I have other affairs. And Monsieur Lichem Roche, he is not quite the King of England, though he seems to think he is.
Barling gave a wry smile.
He did think of himself that way.
Exactly. You comprehend, his letter showed plainly enough that he was what one calls an eccentric. He was not insane, but he was unbalanced, n'est-ce pas?
What he's just done ought to show that.
Oh, monsieur, but suicide is not always the act of the unbalanced. The coroner's jury, they say so, but that is to spare the feelings of those left behind.
Hubert was not a normal individual, said Barling decisively. He was given to ungovernable rages, was a monomaniac on the subject of family pride, and had a bee in his bonnet in more ways than one. But for all that, he was a shrewd man.
Precisely. He was sufficiently shrewd to discover that he was being robbed.
Does a man commit suicide because he's being robbed?
Barling asked.
As you say, monsieur, ridiculous.
And that brings me to the need for haste in the matter. For family reasons, that was the phrase he used in his letter.
Eh bien,
Monsieur, you are a man of the world. You know that it is for precisely that, family reasons, that a man does commit suicide. You mean that it looks, on the face of it, as if ce pauvre monsieur had found out something further, and was unable to face what he had found out. But you perceive I have a duty. I am already employed, commissioned. I have accepted the task, this family reason. The dead man did not want it to get to the police, so I must act quickly. I must learn the truth. And when you have learned it, then I must use my discretion. I must do what I can. I see, said Barling. He smoked for a minute or two in silence. Then he said, All the same, I'm afraid I can't help you. Hubert never confided anything to me. I know nothing. But tell me, monsieur, who, should you say, had a chance of robbing this poor gentleman? Well, difficult to say. Of course, there's the agent for the estate. He's a new man.
The agent?
Yes, Marshall. Captain Marshall. Very nice fellow. Lost an arm in the war. He came here a year ago. But Hubert liked him, I know, and trusted him too.
If it were Captain Marshall who was playing him false, there would be no family reasons for silence.
No.
The hesitation did not escape Poirot. Speak, monsieur. Speak plainly, I beg of you.
Well, it may be gossip.
I implore you, speak.
Well, very well, then, I will. Did you notice a very attractive-looking young woman in the drawing-room?
I noticed two very attractive-looking young women.
Oh, yes, Miss Ashby. Pretty little thing. Her first visit. Harry Dalehouse got Mrs. Litcham Roche to ask her. No, I mean a dark girl. Diana Cleves.
I noticed her, said Poirot.
She is one that all men would notice, I think. She's a little devil, burst out Barling. She's played fast and loose with every man for 20 miles around. Someone will murder her one of these days.
He wiped his brow with a handkerchief, oblivious of the keen interest with which the other was regarding him.
And this young lady is... She's Litcham Roche's adopted daughter. A great disappointment when he and his wife had no children. They adopted Diana Cleves. She was some kind of cousin. Hubert was devoted to her, simply worshipped her.
Doubtless he would dislike the idea of her marrying, suggested Poirot.
Not if she married the right person.
And the right person was you, monsieur?
Barling started and flushed.
I never said...
mais non, you said nothing, but it was so, was it not?
I fell in love with her, yes. Litcham Roche was pleased about it. It fitted in with his ideas for her.
And Mademoiselle herself?
I told you, she's the devil incarnate.
I comprehend.
She has her own ideas of amusement, is it not so?
But Captain Marshall, where does he come in?
Well, she's been seeing a lot of him. People talked. Not that I think there's anything in it. Another scalp, that's all.
Poirot nodded.
But supposing that there had been something in it.
Well, then it might explain why Monsieur Litcham Roche wanted to proceed cautiously. You do understand, don't you, that there's no earthly reason for suspecting Marshall of defalcation?
Oh, parfaitement, parfaitement.
It might be an affair of a forged check with someone in the household involved.
This young Mr. Dalehouse, who is he?
A nephew.
He will inherit? Yes?
He's a sister's son. Of course, he might take the name. There's not a Litcham Roche left.
I see.
The place isn't actually entailed, though it's always gone from father to son. I've always imagined that he'd leave the place to his wife for her lifetime, and then perhaps to Diana, if he approved of her marriage. You see, her husband could take the name.
I comprehend, said Poirot. You have been most kind and helpful to me, monsieur. May I ask of you one thing further? To explain to Madame Litcham Roche all that I have told you, and to beg of her that she accord me a minute?
Sooner than he had thought likely, the door opened, and Mrs. Litcham Roche entered. She floated to a chair.
Mr. Barling has explained everything to me, she said.
We mustn't have any scandal, of course. Though I do feel, really, it's fate. Don't you? I mean with the mirror and everything.
Comment? The mirror?
The moment I saw it, it seemed a symbol of Hubert. A curse, you know. I think old families have a curse very often. Hubert was always very strange. Lately he's been stranger than ever.
You will forgive me for asking, madame, but you are not in any way short of money?
Money? I never think of money.
Do you know what they say, madame?
Those who never think of money need a great deal of it.
He ventured a tiny laugh. She did not respond. Her eyes were far away.
I thank you, madame, he said,
and the interview came to an end. Poirot rang, and Digby answered.
I shall require you to answer a few questions, said Poirot. I am a private detective, sent for by your master before he died.
A detective?
The butler gasped.
Why?
You will please answer my questions. As to the shot now.
He listened to the butler's account.
So there were four of you in the hall.
Yes, sir. Mr. Dalehouse and Miss Ashby and Mr. Keene came from the drawing-room. Where were the others?
The others, sir?
Yes, Mrs. Litcham Roche, Miss Cleves, and Mr. Barling.
Mrs. Litcham Roche and Mr. Barling came down later, sir.
And Miss Cleves?
I think Miss Cleves was in the drawing-room, sir.
Poirot asked a few more questions, then dismissed the butler, with the command to request Miss Cleves to come to him. She came immediately, and he studied her attentively, in view of Barling's revelations. She was certainly beautiful, in her white satin frock with the rosebud on the shoulder. He explained the circumstances which had brought him to Litcham Close, eyeing her very closely, but she showed only what seemed to be genuine astonishment, with no signs of uneasiness. She spoke of Marshall indifferently, with tepid approval. Only at mention of Barling did she approach animation.
That man's a crook, she said sharply. I told the old man so, but he wouldn't listen. Went on putting money into his rotten concerns.
Are you sorry, mademoiselle, that your father is dead?
She stared at him.
Of course. I'm modern, you know, Monsieur Poirot. I don't indulge in sob stuff. But I was fond of the old man. Though, of course, it's best for him.
Best for him?
Yes, one of these days he would have had to be locked up. It was growing on him, this belief that the last Litcham Roche of Litcham Close was omnipotent.
Poirot nodded thoughtfully.
I see. I see.
Yes, decided signs of mental trouble. By the way, you permit that I examine your little bag?
It is charming. All those silk rosebuds.
What was I saying?
Oh, yes. Did you hear the shot?
Oh, yes. But I thought it was a car, or a poacher or something.
You were in the drawing room?
No, I was out in the garden.
I see. Thank you, mademoiselle.
Next, I would like to see Monsieur Keene, is it not? Geoffrey, I'll send him along.
Keene came in, alert and interested. Mr. Barling has been telling me of the reason for your being down here. I don't know that there's anything I can tell you, but if I can... Poirot interrupted him.
I only want to know one thing, Monsieur Keene. What was it that you stooped and picked up just before we got to the study door this evening?
I...
Keene half sprang up from his chair, then subsided again.
I don't know what you mean, he said lightly.
Oh, I think you do, monsieur.
You were behind me. I know, but a friend of mine, he says I have eyes in the back of my head. You picked up something, and you put it in the right-hand pocket of your dinner jacket.
There was a pause. Indecision was written plainly on Keene's handsome face. At last he made up his mind. Take your choice, Monsieur Poirot, he said, and leaning forward he turned his pocket inside out. There was a cigarette holder, a handkerchief, a tiny silk rosebud, and a little gold matchbox. A moment's silence, then Keene said,
As a matter of fact, it was this. He picked up the matchbox. I must have dropped it earlier in the evening.
I think not, said Poirot.
What do you mean?
What I say. I, monsieur, am a man of tidiness, of method, of order.
A matchbox on the ground, I should see it and pick it up. A matchbox of this size, assuredly I should see it. No, monsieur. I think it was something very much smaller. Such as this, perhaps.
He picked up the little silk rosebud.
From Miss Cleave's bag, I think.
There was a moment's pause.
Then Keane admitted it with a laugh. Yes, that's so. She gave it to me last night.
I see, said Poirot.
And at the moment the door opened, and a tall, fair-haired man in a lounge suit strode into the room.
Keane? What's all this? Litcham Roche shot himself? Man, I can't believe it. It's incredible.
Let me introduce you, said Keane, to Monsieur Hercule Poirot.
The other started.
He will tell you all about it.
And he left the room, banging the door.
Monsieur Poirot?
John Marshall was all eagerness.
I'm most awfully pleased to meet you. It's a bit of luck you're being down here. Litcham Roche never told me you were coming. I'm a most frightful admirer of yours, sir.
A disarming young man, thought Poirot. Not so young either, for there was grey hair at the temples and lines on the forehead. It was the voice and manner that gave the impression of boyishness.
The police, they're here now, sir.
I came up with them on hearing the news. They don't seem particularly surprised. Of course, he was mad as a hatter, but even then,
you are surprised at his committing suicide?
Frankly, yes. I shouldn't have thought that Litcham Roche could have imagined the world getting on without him.
He has had money troubles of late, I understand.
Marshall nodded.
He speculated. Wildcat schemes of Barling's.
Poirot said quietly,
I will be frank. Had you any reason to suppose that Mr. Litcham Roche suspected you of tampering with your accounts?
Marshall stared at Poirot in a kind of ludicrous bewilderment. So ludicrous was it that Poirot was forced to smile.
I see that you are utterly taken aback, Captain Marshall.
Yes, indeed. The idea is ridiculous.
Ah, another question. He did not suspect you of robbing him of his adopted daughter?
Oh. So you know about me and I? He laughed in an embarrassed fashion.
It is so, then?
Marshall nodded.
But the old man didn't know anything about it. Di wouldn't have him told. I suppose she was right. He'd have gone up like a basket full of rockets. I should have been chucked out of a job, and that would have been that.
And instead, what was your plan?
Well, upon my word, sir, I hardly know. I left things to Di. She said she'd fix it. As a matter of fact, I was looking out for a job. If I could have got one, I'd have chucked this up.
And Mademoiselle would have married you. But Monsieur Litcham Roche might have stopped her allowance. Mademoiselle Diana is, I should say, fond of money.
Marshall looked rather uncomfortable.
Well, I'd have tried to make it up to her, sir.
Geoffrey Keane came into the room.
The police are just going and would like to see you, Monsieur Poirot.
Merci. I will come.
In the study were a stalwart inspector and the police surgeon.
Monsieur Poirot, said the inspector.
We've heard of you, sir. I'm Inspector Reeves.
You are most amiable, said Poirot, shaking hands.
You do not need my cooperation, no?
He gave a little laugh.
Not this time, sir. All plain sailing.
The case is perfectly straightforward, then? Demanded Poirot.
Absolutely. Door and window locked. Key of door in dead man's pocket. Manner very strange the past few days, no doubt about it.
Everything quite natural?
The doctor grunted.
Yeah. Must have been sitting at a damn queer angle for the bullet to have hit that mirror. But suicide's a queer business.
You found the bullet?
Yes. Yeah.
The doctor held it out. Near the wall, below the mirror. Pistol was Mr. Roche's own. Kept it in the drawer of the desk, always. Something behind it all, I dare say.
But what that is, we shall never know. Poirot nodded. The body had been carried to a bedroom. The police now took their leave. Poirot stood at the front door, looking after them. A sound made him turn. Harry Dalehouse was close behind him.
"Have you by any chance a strong flashlight, my friend?" asked Poirot.
"Oh, yes. I'll get it for you." When he returned with it, Joan Ashby was with him.
"You may accompany me if you like," said Poirot graciously.
He stepped out of the front door and turned to the right, stopping before the study window. About 6 feet of grass separated it from the path. Poirot bent down, playing the flashlight on the grass. He straightened himself and shook his head.
"No," he said, "not there."
Then he paused, and slowly his figure stiffened. On either side of the grass was a deep flower border. Poirot's attention was focused on the right-hand border, full of Michaelmas daisies and dahlias. His torch was directed on the front of the bed. Distinct, on the soft mould, were footprints.
"Four of them," murmured Poirot. "Two going toward the window, two coming from it."
"A gardener," suggested Joan.
"But no, mademoiselle, but no. Employ your eyes. These shoes are small, dainty, high-heeled. The shoes of a woman. Mademoiselle Diana mentioned having been out in the garden. Do you know if she went downstairs before you did, mademoiselle?"
Joan shook her head.
"I can't remember. I was in such a hurry because the gong went, and I thought I'd heard the first one. I do seem to remember that her room door was open as I went past, but I'm not sure. Mrs. Litcham Roche's was shut, I know."
"I see," said Poirot. Something in his voice made Harry look up sharply, but Poirot was merely frowning gently to himself. In the doorway they met Diana Cleaves.
"The police have gone," she said. "It's all over."
She gave a deep sigh.
"May I request one little word with you, mademoiselle?"
She led the way into the morning room, and Poirot followed, shutting the door.
"Well?"
She looked a little surprised.
"One little question, mademoiselle. Were you tonight at any time in the flower border, outside the study window?"
"Yes," she nodded. "About 7 o'clock, and again just before dinner."
"I do not understand," he said.
"Well, I can't see that there is anything to understand, as you call it," she said coldly. "I was picking Michaelmas daisies for the table. I always do the flowers. That was about 7 o'clock."
"And afterward? Later?"
"By that. As a matter of fact, I dropped a spot of hair oil on my dress, just on the shoulder here. It was just as I was ready to come down. I didn't want to change the dress. I remembered I'd seen a late rose in bud in the border. I ran out and picked it and pinned it in. See?"
She came close to him and lifted the head of the rose. Poirot saw the minute grease spot. She remained close to him, her shoulder almost brushing his.
"And what time was this?"
"Oh, about 8:10, I suppose."
"You did not try the window?"
"I believe I did, yes. I thought it would be quicker to go in that way. But it was fastened."
"I see."
Poirot drew a deep breath.
"And the shot," he said. "Where were you when you heard that? Still in the flower border?"
"Oh, no, it was 2 or 3 minutes later, just before I came in by the side door."
"Do you know what this is, mademoiselle?"
On the palm of his hand he held out the tiny silk rosebud. She examined it coolly.
"It looks like a rosebud, off my little evening bag. Where did you find it?"
"It was in Mr. Keene's pocket," said Poirot dryly. "Did you give it to him, mademoiselle?"
"Did he tell you I gave it to him?"
Poirot smiled.
"When did you give it him, mademoiselle?"
"Last night."
"Did he warn you to say that, mademoiselle?"
"What do you mean?"
she asked angrily. But Poirot did not answer. He strode out of the room and into the drawing room.
Barling, Keane, and Marshall were there. He went straight up to them. "Monsieur," he said brusquely, "will you follow me to the study?" He passed out into the hall and addressed Joan and Harry. "You two, I pray of you. And will somebody request Madame to come? I thank you. Ah, and here is the excellent Digby. Digby, a little question, a very important little question. Did Miss Cleves arrange some Michaelmas daisies before dinner?" The butler looked bewildered.
Yes, sir, she did.
Are you sure?
Quite sure, sir.
Très bien. Now, come, all of you. Inside the study, he faced them. I have asked you to come here for a reason. The case is over. The police have come and gone. They say Mr. Litcham Roche has shot himself. All is finished. He paused. But I, Hercule Poirot, say that it is not finished. As startled eyes turned to him, the door opened, and Mrs. Litcham Roche floated into the room. I was saying, madame, that this case is not finished. It is a matter of the psychology. Mr. Litcham Roche, he had the manie de grandeur. He was a king. Such a man does not kill himself. No, no. He may go mad, but he does not kill himself. Mr. Litcham Roche did not kill himself. He paused. He was killed.
Killed?
Marshall gave a short laugh.
Alone in a room, with a door and window locked?
All the same, said Poirot stubbornly, he was killed.
And got up and locked the door and shut the window afterwards, I suppose,
said Diana cuttingly. I will show you something, said Poirot, going to the window. He turned the handle of the French windows and then pulled gently. See? They are open. Now I close them, but without turning the handle. Now the window is closed, but not fastened. Now. He gave a short, jarring blow, and the handle turned, shooting the bolt down into its socket. You see, said Poirot softly, it is very loose, this mechanism. It could be done from outside quite easily. He turned, his manner grim. When that shot was fired, at 8:12, there were 4 people in the hall. 4 people have an alibi. Where were the other 3? You, madame. In your room. You, Monsieur Barling. Were you too in your room?
I was.
And you, mademoiselle, were in the garden. So you have admitted.
I don't see, began Diana.
Wait. He turned to Mrs. Litcham Roche. Tell me, madame, have you any idea of how your husband left his money?
Hubert read me his will. He said I ought to know. He left me 3,000 a year, chargeable on the estate, and the dower house, or the townhouse, whichever I preferred. Everything else he left to Diana, on condition that if she married, her husband must take the name.
Ah.
But then he made a codicil thing, a few weeks ago, that was.
Yes, madame?
He still left it all to Diana, but on condition that she married Mr. Barling. If she married anyone else, it was all to go to his nephew, Harry Dalehouse.
But the codicil was only made a few weeks ago, purred Poirot. Mademoiselle may not have known of that. He stepped forward accusingly. Mademoiselle Diana, you want to marry Captain Marshall, do you not? Or is it Mr. Keane? She walked across the room and put her arm through Marshall's sound one.
Go on, she said.
I will put the case against you, mademoiselle. You loved Captain Marshall. You also loved money. Your adopted father, he would never have consented to your marrying Captain Marshall. But if he dies, you are fairly sure that you get everything. So, you go out. You step over the flower border to the window, which is open. You have with you the pistol, which you have taken from the writing-table drawer. You go up to your victim, talking amiably. You fire. You drop the pistol by his hand, having wiped it, then pressed his fingers on it. You go out again, shaking the window till the bolt drops. You come into the house.
Is that how it happened? I am asking you, mademoiselle.
No!
Diana screamed.
No! No!
He looked at her. Then he smiled.
No,
he said. It was not like that.
It may have been so. It is plausible. It is possible. But it cannot have been like that for two reasons. The first reason is that you picked Michaelmas daisies at 7 o'clock. The second arises from something that Mademoiselle here told me.
He turned toward Joan, who stared at him in bewilderment. He nodded encouragement.
But yes, Mademoiselle, you told me that you hurried downstairs because you thought it was the second gong sounding, having already heard the first.
He shot a rapid glance round the room.
You do not see what that means, he cried.
You do not see. Look, look.
He sprang forward to the chair where the victim had sat.
Did you notice how the body was? Not sitting square to the desk, no. Sitting sideways to the desk, facing the window. Is that a natural way to commit suicide?
Jamais, jamais.
You write your apologia, sorry, on a piece of paper. You open the drawer, you take out the pistol, you hold it to your head, and fire. That is the way of suicide.
But now, consider murder. The victim sits at his desk. The murderer stands beside him, talking. And talking still, fires.
Where does the bullet go then?
He paused.
Straight through the head, through the door, if it is open, and so hits the gong.
Ah, you begin to see.
That was the first gong, heard only by Mademoiselle, since her room is above.
What does our murderer do next?
Shuts the door, locks it, puts the key in the dead man's pocket, then turns the body sideways in the chair, presses the dead man's fingers on the pistol, and then drops it by his side. Cracks the mirror on the wall as a final spectacular touch. In short, arranges his suicide.
Then, out through the window, the bolt is shaken home, the murderer steps not on the grass where footprints must show, but on the flower bed, where they can be smoothed out behind him, leaving no trace. Then, back into the house, and at 8:12, when he is alone in the drawing room, he fires a service revolver out of the drawing room window and dashes out into the hall.
Is that how you did it, Mr. Geoffrey Keane?
Fascinated, the secretary stared at the accusing figure drawing nearer to him. Then, with a gurgling cry, he fell to the ground.
I think I am answered, said Poirot.
Captain Marshall, will you ring up the police?
He bent over the prostrate form.
I fancy he will still be unconscious when they come.
Geoffrey Keane, murmured Diana.
But what motive had he?
I fancy that as secretary he had certain opportunities. Accounts, checks.
Something awakened Mr. Litcham Roche's suspicions. He sent for me.
Why for you? Why not the police?
I think, mademoiselle, you can answer that question.
Monsieur suspected that there was something between you and that young man. To divert his mind from Captain Marshall, you had flirted shamelessly with Mr. Keane.
But yes, you need not deny. Mr. Keane gets wind of my coming and acts promptly. The essence of his scheme is that the crime must seem to take place at 8:12 when he has an alibi. His one danger is the bullet, which must be lying somewhere near the gong, and which he has not had time to retrieve. When we are all on our way to the study, he picks that up. At such a tense moment, he thinks no one will notice. But me, I notice everything. I question him. He reflects a little minute, and then he plays the comedy. He insinuates that what he picked up was the silk rosebud. He plays the part of the young man in love, shielding the lady he loves. Oh, it was very clever. And if you had not picked Michaelmas daisies...
I don't understand what they have to do with it.
You do not?
Listen.
There were only 4 footprints in the bed. But when you were picking the flowers, you must have made many more than that. So, in between your picking the flowers and your coming to get the rosebud, someone must have smoothed over the bed.
Not a gardener.
No gardener works after 7.
Then it must be someone guilty.
It must be the murderer. The murder was committed before the shot was heard.
But Why did nobody hear the real shot?
Asked Harry. A silencer. They will find that, and the revolver thrown into the shrubbery.
What a risk!
Why a risk?
Everyone was upstairs, dressing for dinner. It was a very good moment. The bullet was the only contretemps, and even that, as he thought, passed off well.
Poirot picked it up.
He threw it under the mirror when I was examining the window with Mr. Dalehouse.
Oh!
Diana wheeled on Marshall. Marry me, John, and take me away.
Barling coughed. My dear Diana, under the terms of my friend's will...
I don't care, the girl cried. We can draw pictures on pavements. There's no need to do that, said Harry. We'll go halves, Di. I'm not going to bag things because Uncle had a bee in his bonnet.
Suddenly there was a cry. Mrs. Litcham Roche had sprung to her feet.
Monsieur Poirot, the mirror, he must have deliberately smashed it.
Yes, madame.
Oh.
She stared at him.
But it is unlucky to break a mirror.
It has proved very unlucky for Mr. Geoffrey Keane, said Poirot cheerfully.
We hope you have enjoyed The Second Gong, a Hercule Poirot short story by Agatha Christie, performed by Hugh Fraser. Text copyright 1948, Agatha Christie Limited. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2004-2006, HarperCollins Publishers Limited. All rights reserved. If you've enjoyed this Agatha Christie story, don't miss The Witness for the Prosecution and other stories. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.